Welcome to the latest podcast from the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
Today we're going to be talking about one of the most iconic fish in the hobby, and all of the fish that go along with it.
I think this is a category of fish that we can probably say any one of our listeners that has kept fish has probably kept one.
At least once.
Yeah. That's probably the only group of fish we could say that about.
I want to start out with the biggest pet peeve in the hobby, though, as far as I'm concerned, and that is the mispronunciation of the name of this fish.
Oh my gosh, it's the thing that I feel the guiltiest correcting people on, but I do every single time.
I don't know why it is so much to me like fingernails on chalkboard. Fingernails on chalkboard might be better, particularly if I hear occasionally what I would consider a well-educated fish person call it a betta fish.
Have I ever told you my story of the one time I corrected someone in the store and there was someone else who was really excited about that?
No, I don't think so.
So, betta is Greek.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Betta is a Malay word for biting fish.
There's some discrepancy on that, actually.
A little bit, but that's not important right now. Right. What's important is apparently we had someone who speaks Malay in the store when I did that once, and she goes, "Thank you."
Oh my gosh, how often do you meet someone who speaks Malay?
Yeah.
That's perfect. Whenever you see that name written, note, there are two T's, not one. The second letter of the Greek alphabet has one T. The word betta has two. It's betta.
Yep. It's that simple, although it is a little bit more fun than that, too, in some ways.
It's the betta pronunciation.
That's much better. Thank you, Charles.
And Charles, I don't know. Maybe we have our lines crossed, but I have placat as the one that means biting fish.
You're right. Yeah, I got my lines crossed there.
Yeah, because there is a story, another story for where the betta term actually comes from.
Yeah.
Which was what Ben was trying to bring up.
I believe it is a made-up word by the guy who did the original description of betta picta, which originally was described as a killifish in 1846. Panchax pictum was the first described member of the genus betta, and they thought it was a killie.
Well, the folklore goes that betta is the name of a warrior tribe in that region.
I've heard that one too.
I haven't heard, you know, this is what the betta tribe is and this right. is what they believe, but like that would make the scientific name betta splendens translate to something like splendid warrior, you know, and that's really what they are.
I think that sounds really cool, but I think that's one of those. I think it's folklore.
Yeah.
I don't think it's true.
It's a cool urban legend. I would love to see some historical documentation that proves that.
Right.
Either way, it's a story I like to believe.
Yep. Yep. We often tell that story around here because it makes people remember to stop calling it after the second letter of the Greek alphabet.
Yeah.
Okay, enough on my rant. I'll try not to bring it up again. It might come up again, but I'll try not to bring it up again. So when we're talking about a betta, it is a genus of fish that includes betta splendens, which is what everybody thinks of when you think of bettas. But there are something like 86 described species so far and counting in the genus betta. We are going to talk about wild type, what we refer to as wild type bettas. In other words, those betta species that haven't been messed with. We're going to talk about some of the really cool domestic strains out there because there really is some fun work being done with these fish, and I think that's pretty cool. And we're going to talk about care and variety and some breeding. Anyway, we're going to spend the whole time talking about
this might bettas. Be one of the more controversial fish that we talk about because people have some strong opinions about their bettas.
Oh, the betta police.
Yes.
I hope you're listening. Wow.
What's the? Aren't we like the sheriff town right here? Like,
this is one of the few ones that we probably get less up in arms about than hobbyists.
I think that's true. Yeah.
Okay, now I understand what you're alluding to. I get it.
Yeah.
Right. So, what do you think, guys? Should we talk about? Well, let's go with some betteral general, Beta general facts. So general beta. What should we talk about first, guys?
Let's go with the domesticated strains, just because I think that's what people are first introduced to. So yeah. I think it's good to work on that. And then if you want to dive deeper and keep listening to the podcast, we'll start getting into the more complicated stuff.
I like that idea.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So I guess where bettas probably first came onto the radar of humans would be in Siam in the early 1800s, where they began to use them for fighting. The king of Siam at that time actually had like licensing over those fights, so he made a ton of money off of betta fighting.
Wow.
And so did a ton of people. It was like a huge trade at that time.
Yeah.
And that's where they sifted into being kept as pets. They were described originally as Macropodus pugnax, I think, and that was already a fish, so they had to change it to Betta splendens.
And that change happened like much later, because the original description was like in the 1840s.
Yeah.
And then it took until like 1910 for them to be like, oh, wait, we already have a fish named that.
Yeah, I think officially described in 1909. And yeah, that was 50 years.
Yeah.
60 years.
I had officially described in 1846.
It was described officially for the first time in...
Oh, officially named Betta splendens.
It was officially named Macropodus pugnax at that time. Betta splendens didn't happen until, like, well, I guess 70 years later from what I read.
But that's the description of Betta splendens, not
the fish,
bettas in general.
Yeah, the fish was described, and then the name was updated later on.
Updated later. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Macropodus.
I wonder if Pictum... So originally Panchex Pictum in 1846. I wonder if Panchex Pictum was ever in Micropodus.
It could have been.
Probably was.
I mean, it seemed like the 1800s for naturalists was pretty like the Wild West.
Throw a bunch of cards on the table and pick them up, and that's what we get.
So it's like, I named this. This is what it is. And there was definitely some more organization than that, but there was a lot going on there in terms of describing species.
Yeah, and... Oh man, I almost want to poke at it a little bit, like, because of the way European colonization works, a lot of our information on stuff like this has a very European-centric view on it. So like, there's a lot of evidence that betta breeding in those regions was happening for several centuries. It's just not until documentation on the European side is it on the radar? Because there's probably a good argument to be made that we destroyed other evidence. And I'm like, whoops.
European history is the only history.
Right.
Yeah.
But well, that doesn't make sense, Charles. We would never do that.
No. But to my knowledge, like on the more bright side, I guess, the first bettas that made it into the States were the veiltail varieties. And they didn't make it into, like, the States until, like, the 1920s. Which I think is just a quick fun fact. Did you know that Shedd Aquarium was the first place in the United States to have neon tetras?
I did not know that.
That's pretty cool.
That's a great fact.
Yeah, they had the first six.
Wow.
How different the world is now.
I found one instance where, like, it was reported that Betta splendens was collected and imported into San Francisco in like the early 1900s, but it was brought in as Betta Cambodia because it was a white and red one. So now that's known as like a Cambodian betta.
Oh yeah.
But it was like one of the first strains of Betta splendens to come into the hobby. And it was like, they just decided it was a different species. It was Betta Cambodia, and then went back and changed that later on.
But it was just a selectively bred.
Yeah, yeah, what probably from Southeast Asia somewhere where it had been already bred a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. I think it might be worthwhile to talk a little bit about like the cultural aspect of how these were selectively bred originally.
Yeah, Amy, talk more about that.
Talk more about which what?
Well, you started out with the fighting fish of Siam and the king of Siam.
Mm-hmm. Bettas were originally in captivity, not for the purposes of ornamentals or for the purposes of pets. They were there for fighting. So that has probably the longest history of the species. It wasn't until recently where they were, and I say recently in the last 100 years, where they were even considered as pets.
Well, there is speculation, and I'm saying this is clearly speculative, because by the time the United States gets in on the hobby, the veiltail form had already been established. Yeah. So there is a hypothesis that the same people, because there was kind of a prestige to being able to breed a good fighting betta, because if you look at the Placade strains, they're like about the same length as a wild Splendens, but it's like 2 or 3 times stockier. Yeah. They got more stamina. They're crazy fish.
It's a beefy looking fish.
They're muscular.
And then you look at some of the like veil tail varieties and they're a little bit smaller. There is a line of evidence that maybe these same guys that were breeding them for fighting bred, and a lot of that was taught like father to son, that the veil tail varieties were bred for their daughters because they were like, oh, look, it's cute. And they're like,
I would definitely believe that.
Yeah. And I can imagine a father being like, oh, I can get my daughter in on this too. This is great. Like,
but that fighting history is what leads them to their modern reputation where, oh, they're just the super aggressive fish that can't be kept with anything. And in some cases that's true, but rare ones. And at this point, I think they're mainly being bred for coloration and personality. So that super aggressive trait has started to be bred out of them. That's what I believe.
Although I will admit, even in the modern Placade strains, that's a no-go for me because they're definitely much feistier. But if you're going for the longer tail, especially the half moons,
oh yeah,
they seem to be a lot more calm. But
oh,
I would
slow.
But I would still be cautious.
Yeah, like I would never keep them together. But you can keep them with plenty of other fish.
I would be more cautious with any domesticated strain of betta than I would be any of the wild types.
Absolutely.
For sure. It was pretty notable that the first time we successfully got in a batch of wild-caught betta splendens, we got 6 of them, and they were all shipped in the same bag.
Yeah.
Males and females all shipped in the same bag.
Yeah.
And they were fine.
I talked to somebody about those wild-caught betta splendens, because that's a pretty rare thing. Like, we did not really think that betta splendens were still being collected in the wild that much. And I remember I mentioned it to somebody who was looking at it, you know, because we have, like, one female left, and she is not the prettiest fish. She's got a lot of spunk, but she's a wild betta splendid, and so she's not that impressive. And so I was saying, oh yeah, we were really surprised. We didn't really think that fish were being imported that much, betta splendens, the wild types, and whatever. I was trying to explain it to him. And this is a guy who's been a little, like, snobby to me about his knowledge of wild bettas, and he was like, well, you know, there's like, they still get the Cambodian ones and stuff. I'm like, dude, you have no idea what I'm trying to say to you. Never mind, throw the conversation away. You didn't get it.
There is some speculation out there that the origins of what we know of as domestic strain betta splendens are actually some crosses between 2 or 3 of the other bettas in that complex, and we'll talk about complex a little bit when we get into the wild type species, but Mahakanensis,
Smeridina, Imbellus.
Yes, Imbellus was the other main one I was thinking of.
And that's the thing that gets really tricky, because since they're hybridized like that, even in the wild, there's some mixing going on there, because breeding for fighting, there isn't a strong incentive to not cross lines, especially when you're like, you're trying to breed for a specific purpose. So if you got a good fighting fish that's from the south, which would probably be Imbellus, and you import it in, and your region's native is Splendens. And that's the part that, like, trying to find wild type Splendens that are non-hybridized gets really tricky. Like the last time we got an Imbellus, do you remember my first comment on them? My first comment was, these clearly have some Splendens in them. These are not true Imbellus.
It's got to be the case that 100 years ago, 150 years ago, when 2 villages from different areas were getting together, and I'm making this up a little bit, but that they would get together and fight their bettas, the losers would end up dead, but some of those fish would end up just going back in the water.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure, too, like, in those circles, there would be plenty of trading back and forth and mixing of.
Now, I want to make a correction here. They did not fight bettas to the death. That was a very big taboo. Because because there was a big, someone spent a lot of effort breeding that.
Right.
And so
it's an asset.
Yeah. Some people's like homes were like valued less than their fish. So there was a very strict rule on when the fight is over, when one of the bettas doesn't want to fight anymore. And that's how they decided winners.
I'm sure that as the practice got more modernized, it probably got a little bit more vicious as well, a little bit less restraint. As in, probably the original, because it was a very traditional thing, like it was a part of the culture. I'm sure there are plenty of betta fighting circles where the fish do not make it.
Perhaps, but in the ones that are documented, yeah, it's very clear that they're like, no, someone worked really hard to breed it. Don't kill it. Like,
that's good to know. That makes me feel a little bit better about it, even though there is in no way, shape, or form that we in any way would endorse making animals fight for entertainment.
Yeah, that bred-in aggression is definitely, it's still there among the domestic bettas. And I will get on a soapbox about betta sororities. Female bettas are not by default any less aggressive than male bettas. That's what I will say.
Of my domesticated bettas I've kept in my life, the worst offender I ever had was a female.
Yeah.
She would destroy, she was gorgeous. I wanted to breed her. She killed 3 males.
Wow.
And I said, all right, well, 3's a trend. I'm done trying that. Like,
yeah, I think the people who want to keep sororities keep them because they have a betta that they love and is cute and has a ton of personality and is beautiful and they like that pet and they want more of them. And I've heard so many like people come in like upset that their sorority didn't work out. And it's like, it's basically keeping an African cichlid tank. You're keeping a bunch of really aggressive fish densely populated together and hoping that none of them can get one over on the other ones.
There's a store not far from here that has, I think it's like a 120 or a 160 that has like 100 female bettas in it.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful display. But there's 100 fish in 100 gallons.
Yeah.
Those fish have a lot of room and a lot of competition to decide who's feisty and who's not.
Yeah, 3 in a 10-gallon is asking for a disaster.
Not long term.
Yeah.
So this is where I offer my alternative to the betta sorority, which is wild-type bettas.
Thank you. Exactly.
The blue sheen on Maha canensis.
They're stunning.
It's incredible.
I could see someone arguing that a dragon scale betta is prettier, but the fact that a lot of them go blind because of the makes me say the Mahakiensis is clearly superior in my book because it's just as pretty, but it doesn't have the risk of going blind most of the time.
Right.
Yeah.
And so while we're talking about wild types here instead of like really going into the domestic strain, although I guess we're doing both. Anyway, fun fact, betta Mahakiensis. Lots of the impression of wild type bettas out there is, yeah, but then I got to soften my water and blah, 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 and yada, yada, yada. And is it okay for Michigan tap water? Betta mahakinensis has been found in brackish water.
Yeah.
Not just found, most of its habitat is brackish water. Right.
That means the hard water that we have here in Michigan is fantastic for betta mahakinensis, and their colors will be amazing in West Michigan tap water.
Yeah, you're not sacrificing anything with that fish to keep it around here.
Yep.
Even, I would say, most of the species that we've gotten in do just fine in our water. We might need a little bit more experimentation to say that those mostly breed just fine in our water. But we've had some success.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. All right, so basic betta splendens care. I remember the trend going around for a while of the betta vase.
Gross.
It was so bad. And a lot of people, and I think maybe this is where the impression of a betta container being too small came from. Because those betta vases were often a half a gallon. And a lot of the bettas didn't survive in those betta vases. But anybody who remembers those betta vases might remember one very, very important detail about how those were built. And it had nothing to do with the volume of water. So I'm going to digress with a little bit of a story here. one of my friends in 1994 was noted by a now defunct aquarium fish magazine, Freshwater and Marine Aquarium.
I remember that.
Right. In 94, there was a 2-page article written about him as being labeled the best betta breeder in the world.
It's a bold claim.
It's a bold claim. And at that time, if you would do any research about it, you couldn't argue it. He was. He helped develop the half-moon strain of bettas. That was his huge contribution to the hobby. So all of those people concerned about size, where this guy kept his prize show bettas. Oh, by the way, he held the record at the time for the highest price paid for a freshwater fish. His prize show bettas, award-winning show bettas, were all kept in 1-gallon jars. Fish bowls, drum bowls, every single one of them.
That honestly sounds like a nightmare of maintenance to me.
Well, you know, he's German, so yeah. He had that meticulousness. So size is not the concern. There's an amazing video out there of collecting wild bettas. And the little pocket of water in the base of a juvenile palm tree that's about a half a gallon to a gallon, there's a video out there of somebody pulling like 5 bettas out of one of those.
I'm sure they were so happy in there.
Right. That size, that was not the concern. Okay, back to the vases that were just such a
yeah,
big...
Yeah, I would never keep a betta in less than a gallon.
Right,
yeah.
But a gallon is fine.
I mean, you can keep them alive. It's just not very fun.
But a gallon is fine.
Eh, I probably wouldn't keep one in less than 5 gallons, personally.
Yeah, I'm fine with a gallon.
I mean, I don't think it's cruel. It's just boring.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, you can keep the water clean, like whatever, yeah. But...
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely utilitarianism to keeping them in 1 gallons when you're breeding.
Yeah. Well, and then you can go through and you can do massive water changes regularly if you need to.
Right.
Or, I mean, you really probably don't. I mean, you can keep that water clean easily. I think the real, like, the real backlash comes from if you go to a big box store and you go to betta section, most of the tanks there are going to be less than a gallon. And marketed towards beginners. Yeah. And I don't think a tank that's less than a gallon that you're putting any fish in can be a beginner tank.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And less than a gallon means the step down is usually a half gallon.
Yeah.
Or
I mean,
they're
a quart
sold
sometimes.
In these little quart jars. And that's just not okay. Back to the betta vases.
Yeah.
What they did with the betta vases is they put a tray on the top of the vase with some rocks in it. And that's where usually a peace lily was planted in that tray. So the roots down into the tank, or what quote unquote filtered the tank and kept everything healthy. What's the problem with that? So, Betta splendens is a member of the genus Betta, which is a member of the family
Anabantidae.
Anabantidae, thank you very much.
Anabantoids. Nothing worse than reaching for a word and not being able to get it.
Thanks for having my back on that one, Amy. Always appreciate it. Anabantidae are labyrinth fish. Labyrinth fish have an organ in their forehead to allow them to breathe atmospheric oxygen. There are various levels of functionality in that labyrinth organ and with the gills. With betta splendens, the gills are almost completely not functional.
Particularly the domestic variants.
Right. That means betta splendens needs atmospheric oxygen. Where do they get that atmospheric oxygen? From the surface. They grab a bubble, they pass the bubble through the maze or labyrinth organ in their forehead and extract the oxygen from it. So if you put a cover on your little betta vase and put your betta in there and the betta can't get to the surface, the betta's going to drown. Yes, you can drown a betta.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I will take it a step further and then say, I am aware, I have encountered people who are like, well, if I leave a pocket of air, and I'm like, no, it's not an herbivore, it's a carnivore. Like, stop, right. Stop trying. Because a part of that vase thing was the concept that you wouldn't have to feed it because it would eat the roots.
It would feed off the microbes that the roots produce.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That work? No.
Yeah, I suppose at that point its metabolism would be running so slowly in the cold water with no food, and it might not need that much oxygen anymore.
Yeah, that's true, as it dies a slower pace. Yeah. Well, they only live for a month, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you just get a new one.
I would think that we'd be a little bit more appreciative of bettas, given that they're, like, the Splendens complex in particular, they're specialized mosquito predators. Right. Like,
so we're alluding to tank size, we're alluding to temperature, and we're alluding to food. Break it down, Amy.
All right. Well, like we said, there probably isn't a minimum tank size to keep a betta healthy. I would say smallest comfortable size for easy maintenance, probably a 2.5. Personally, I'd probably go for something like a 5 because it's not that much bigger and it gives you a lot more volume.
And it's easier to get all that equipment in there.
Yeah. And a bowl is definitely doable. And if you're going to do a bowl and that's the only thing you want, a betta is the only fish to go for.
Agreed.
So tank size, probably not the most crucial part. Filtration, probably not the most crucial part because they get most of their oxygen from the surface. And if you're doing a one fish tank, you really don't need a lot more filtration.
And feeding it properly.
Yeah, and feeding it properly.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, bettas are super prone to obesity, so overfeeding is a major concern with them. I've seen a lot of fat, bloated bettas that look miserable by people who feed them as often as they ask for food. And that's really when water quality becomes a concern as well. Like, just your typical maintenance water quality issues aren't a problem with a betta, but when you're dumping a ton of food in there, they become a problem very quickly. The most important piece of equipment in a betta tank, I would say, is the heater.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah. Strip out. You don't need a light. You don't need a filter. Heater, never do without. They
absolutely
are truly
must.
Tropical fish, so that's the one thing that's definitely worth it to splurge for bettas. Mid to high 70s at least. Any bettas that are below that, and honestly, it's to the point at this time where if I get a call and somebody says their betta's sick, my first question is, do you have a heater? Because if you don't, it's probably going to be sick.
That's, yeah, like, it shouldn't be underestimated that they are true tropical fish. Like, my recommended range is 76 to 82.
Yeah.
They are definitely at the high end of that.
Which means if you keep your house at 72 degrees in the wintertime, your betta is too cold.
Yes.
What's 4 degrees? That's not that big of a deal. Well, the human body temperature, average body temperature, is 98.6. If you have a 4 degree higher body temperature, you're likely to be hospitalized.
Yeah, ask the ocean what 4 degrees means.
Yeah. Well, and that's one thing that a lot of people underestimate, especially with, what's the word I'm looking for? Poikilotherms, which is cold-blooded animals. Because 10 degrees in most species generally equates a either halving or doubling of your metabolism for them. So 4 degrees is their metabolism is running probably almost half of what it would be in its normal range.
My betta is lethargic and it just lays at the bottom of the tank. I don't know what's wrong.
I keep dropping food on his head and he's not eating.
It's trying to go into borderline hibernative state because it's too cold and they're not made to hibernate.
Well, yeah, think about like that. The air in those areas is probably 90 degrees or whatever.
Yeah.
And these are from shallow areas. Like, what do you think the temperature is in the top of that coconut tree? You know, that water's probably like 100 degrees.
I have never tried it, but they can take temperatures so much hotter than we think.
Yeah, they can.
Right.
And then when it comes to feeding, I am going to harp on this a little bit.
Good.
Because I have had 3 text conversations in the last week where people sent me pictures asking what's wrong with their fish. In 3 of those conversations, the answer was, you're overfeeding.
What's wrong with my fish and why is the water cloudy?
I think my fish is sick. It has dropsy.
No, your bet is just fat.
Yeah.
And cold.
So you really want a high quality pellet food because bettas are not fast. So like flake foods are okay for something like a tetra that's zippy enough to catch it before it starts melting. Bettas are not. And a pellet food also more replicates like the bug type thing so they can digest it better, et cetera.
Floating pellet.
Yep. And you want it to be a carnivorous pellet. You want to be looking out for formulations that have a lot of like plant matter in it, because that can cause problems for bettas too, long term.
Yeah, a lot of those cheaper foods, the first ingredient is like wheat, and humans can barely digest wheat. Bettas right. cannot.
Think
really.
Of a lion grazing on a bunch of grass.
Yeah, you don't see that every day.
Have you ever seen Futurama? There's one episode where they're like, it's natural for things to eat other animals. And they're like, no, we taught a lion to eat tofu. And it pans over and there's this like lion that's like half the weight of a normal lion.
Yeah, there was a weird trend while I was working at a chain pet store of people trying to get their get their dogs and cats to go vegan. Like, if you can't handle it, don't have a cat or a dog.
Right.
They cannot. They
that's
just cannot.
Not what they're built for.
Yeah.
Anyway,
humans can...
Yeah.
You're right. Anyways, we're talking.
I was like, wow,
could we go down a rabbit hole there? Let's not do that.
Pretty good time to start transitioning over to the wild species.
Well, let me finish with the feeding thing.
You're still, yeah. Okay.
Because I was like,
keep ranting, Charles.
Like,
keep ranting.
Depending on the size of the pellet, and if you bring in a pellet food or even just text the store what you got, I generally have an idea of pellet size of most betta brands. I'll tell you how many pellets you should be feeding a day, but depending on your brand, somewhere between 2 and 5 pellets a day, and that's it.
Usually, it's gonna feel like you're starving the fish. You're not. You're keeping it healthy.
Usually at least half of what the package recommends.
Yeah. Let's. I think Amy is the one that said this. She was like, well, my advice is based on what's good for the fish. What's on the package is based on what's good for business.
Yeah, the more you use, the more they're going to sell. So
I'm amazed by that sometimes. When we have, so overfeeding, don't worry, it's a very short rant. The biggest conversation we have with people when they come in the store and say they're having problems, like I almost have to say always, but I should say almost always, whether they're talking about a betta or a saltwater fish or a community tank, whatever it is. The number one conversation is you're overfeeding. And when I tell people don't read the side of the package, this is what you have to feed. Feed less. That means we, as a retail store, will be selling less fish food.
Yeah.
And we're telling you to buy less stuff from us.
Why would
we
say that?
Our ulterior motive is, thank you for the silence, because... It's not. Come on.
It's just a conspiracy.
Yeah. Here's
people
your tinfoil hat.
Come in saying, what am I doing wrong? And you say, oh, it's simple. You're doing this wrong. And then they get upset about it.
Right.
Anyway. So if we're going to convert this betta setup we're talking about for wild bettas, I
yes.
think people will find that we can generalize a lot more than
we
you'd
can,
think.
Because there's a betta for every... circumstance.
Yeah.
There really is.
So
I think we'll start off with the splendens complex because
yeah.
the general answer is care is basically the same as a betta splendens.
Right.
Yeah, except for you can keep several of them.
Yeah, like people are still shocked. So downstairs we have in one of our 5 gallons, we have 2 male smeridinas and they do not bother each other.
They're fine.
Yeah.
So like
in a 5, yeah.
Yeah, so like 5 to 10 gallons, you can easily keep a trio or a pair. Maybe even 2 pairs. I don't know. Depending
yeah.
on your group.
Yeah.
And without problems in this.
Yeah. At that point, the concern is less going to be aggression as long as you have hiding places for those ones that aren't dominant. And it's just more going to be water quality. Like how many fish can you put in a tank before it starts getting dirty too fast?
Yep.
But
lots of like floating plants and
yeah.
stuff so they can have like their little hidey holes and make nests. And you might get babies in that kind of setup.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, keep it warm.
Yeah.
Keep it warm.
So what are the fish in the splendens complex?
All right. That would be Imbellus, Cyam orientalis, Smeridina, Stichcos. And if anyone can find me a source of those, I want it now. because I will admit, I saw them once at one of the GVAC events. And I don't know why I didn't buy them because I'm stupid. And I have never seen them since.
Oh, we'll find them again.
And then Mahakiensis. And then there are some kind of like pseudo described forms that are at this point function as like Smeridina might function as 2 or 3 species, depending on the genetics. And I think I told you about this. I actually contacted the scientist from Thailand who did this research. And I said, so in the American aquarium industry, we recognize 3 strains of Smeridina. Do these roughly correlate with the 3 lineages you find in your hob- in your paper. And he said, so the lineages were labeled as CP1, CP2, CP3. And so CP1, he said, correlates with the type specimen, which was what we consider a standard Smeridina. CP2 correlates with what we would call a Guettard Smeridina. And then he said, CP3 has probably never made it into the American market because the third type we recognize in the American market are copper Smeridinas. And he said that those are actually a selectively bred line of CP1.
Nice.
And it was so cool to be able to, like, he sent me a detailed list in this email of, like, this is how to cross-reference it. It was so cool.
How satisfying to get answers.
So let me just do a little digression here, and let's define, so our listeners know what we're talking about when we're saying complex. Mm-hmm. There's some very specific reasons to use the word complex. And it's when we're talking about 86 different species in the genus Betta, of those 86 different species, there are groups within those that have certain similarities. So the complex that includes Betta splenda and Smeridina and Mahakonnensis, all of those fish have some unifying characteristics. So in that complex, all of them are going to be in neutral to hard water. They're all going to be of similar size. The males are all going to have particularly bright colors. And they're all going to be bubble nesters.
Yep.
So that kind of helps define that complex a little bit. And every single one of the complexes out there, of which I have the number, and I'll come up with the number, every single one of those complexes have some characteristics that say, okay, we can't put you in a different genus yet, but there's something similar about these guys. And that really helps from a hobby perspective because we know care of Betta embolus and care of Betta splendens is going to be very similar.
And one thing to keep in mind is that complexes are normally derived from morphological, meaning like how they look, how they're structured, traits. And so they're generally assumed to be more closely related to each other. So like when I say splendens complex, the assumption at this point is that fish in the splendens complex are more related to each other than they are to fish in other complexes within the same genus. I say assumed because when you have the genetic data, it often rearranges that a little bit, and then you can define it as a clade. But Betta genetics is only really starting to be touched now, and what we're finding so far is it's really messy. What we thought was Smeridina, probably three different species.
That makes total sense. So let's buzz through it a little bit. About a third of Bettas are bubble nesters, which means the other two-thirds are mouth brooders, with a few of them that are able to switch back and forth. So what's a bubble nest?
A bubble nest is when a Betta, they use mucus that they form in their mouth to create a, I don't want to say stable, but far more stable bubble than normal. And then it can kind of stack them on each other and build a nest at the surface or submerged. But Bettas don't normally do that. That's more reserved for something like a licorice gourami.
Actually, there are one or two complexes that have cave nesters.
So when they do that, they're normally switch hitters. So most of the submerged bubble nesting Bettas that I'm aware of are either mouth brooders that'll switch hit, and then there are some in the Cocina complex that will develop nests at the surface or submerged, but they do seem to have a preference for we film canisters as the favorite. So I wouldn't classify that as submerged because what you're trying to simulate is a leaf at the top. So it's just a like backbone to the nest, but yeah. Anyways.
So the three complexes that include the bubble nesters, the Bellica complex, the Coxina complex, and the Splendens complex. Bellica and Coxina. Bellica is very underrepresented in the hobby.
Yeah.
And they're kind of boring brown fish.
Will you run down the species in that so I know which ones?
So that would be Bellica and Sonorum. The Sonorum were actually gorgeous when we got them in. They were kind of like an emerald.
Those
were an emerald green. Those were crazy.
Those were very cool.
So when you list off those complexes, so I just want to everyone else to appreciate the joke. When you said Splendens, in my head I said the pretty ones, and then you said the casino ones, and I said the cute little ones, and then you said the Bellicon, I said the big boys.
That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah.
I would personally argue that the casino complex is prettier.
No, I 100% agree with that. But
yeah, I would actually agree with that too.
I 100% believe that casino complex is more gorgeous, but there is a perception that like Mahakansas, Meridina, like that's more accessible to a lot of people that I'm trying to sell
Wild Bettas to.
I think that like I might say the casino complex is the one that I think has the most value to hobbyists in general.
They are so like, cute.
I would love to see more people keep those. I think more than any of the other complexes that I can think of, they're
those
adorable.
Very much are. They fall in the category of very killifish-like.
Yeah, I can
they're
see
they're smaller. The colors are very, very bold. They do pretty much all come from black water habitats.
Yeah.
Which
that's,
is
that's
bold
the hard part.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're beautiful all the time.
They're amazing.
But the trade-off is they're small enough that most people keep Cosina pairs, and I'm saying male-female pair, in a like 2.5 to 5 gallon tank, and that's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I wouldn't bat an eye. And I'm someone who like always goes for greater water volumes, and I would still probably keep a pair of Betta Cosina and
I have a pair of Betta Hendra and a 2.5 downstairs right now.
Betta Hendra is Betta Hendra and Betta Bonera are my two favorite in that complex, right? Yeah. Betta Hendra is an amazing blue color.
So fun fact about Betta Hendra, there is some debate as to whether it belongs in the Cosina complex. The alternative is people are arguing that it belongs in its own complex.
That wouldn't surprise me because if you look at Brunnerum and Cosina, there's some really strong similarities in the way they look. But
I always thought Hendra and Persephone were
so Persephone and Miniopina
yeah.
are the two blue boys, and they tend to be there's speculation that they are a sister clade, but their genetic evidence hasn't come out to prove or disprove that idea. But Hendra might be different enough from the rest of them because to be its own thing.
Originally, it was described as a subspecies of Persephone, right?
Yeah. But
that's when probably why I have that assumption.
But when you look at Hendra, they actually have a different life history than everything else in the Cosina complex. So Betta Cosina, despite being small, they come from a very nutrient-poor habitat, and so they actually produce, for their size, small nest and large offspring. Betta Hendra doesn't do that.
Right.
They produce comparatively much more and far smaller offspring. And that trade-off
love
is
these fish.
The trade-off with Cosina is what they're doing is they are producing fewer offspring, but investing more resources into each individual one to increase an individual's chance of survival.
Right.
Yeah. And those casinas are really cute.
They're gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the brown orums, they're pretty cool because they're that like ruby red color, and they'll get that emerald on the side.
I thought brown orum meant brown.
Not
they ain't brown.
Oh, no. And these are the fish that, like I said, I think they are appealing to hobbyists because they are great candidates for a nano community.
Yes.
And
definitely.
Probably not. I mean, I would even say some of the smaller species in there might be adult shrimp safe, but not baby shrimp safe.
Yeah.
Definitely safe with little fish of any size, I would say.
Treat them like a killie.
Yeah.
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 The last group in that complex is the Bellicon complex, and I completely forgot about Sonorum when I kind of dismissed them as something we don't care about.
Mean.
I know, right?
They're big. Like, they are by far the largest bubble nesters because they can get like 4 or 5 inches.
That's a big betta.
And so because of that, I feel like maybe minimum size for those, for a pair of those, should be like 15, 20 gallons. Maybe 10 if you're being really conscientious, because that's just a big fish.
How big do they get?
Like 5 inches.
Like, wow. Because I remember when we got the Samorums, and they were probably 3 inches when we got them, 2 or 3.
Yeah.
You kept having to remind me that they're bubble nesters.
They definitely look like a mouth brooding beta species.
Do. That alone makes them cool.
Yeah. I guess that's a good transition to mouth brooding.
So this is the fun thing about mouth brooders. Most bettas are mouth brooders. 2/3 of the group are mouth brooders. In fact, I know the lumpers and the splitters are fighting right now as to whether or not mouth brooders and bubble nesters should be in the same genus. If the splitters win, Betta splendens will technically no longer be a betta because the type species for the group was a mouth brooder.
That would be amazing.
I know, right?
I would just love to see the chaos that would ensue. And it, honestly, it, there probably wouldn't be any chaos. They would keep calling them bettas. You know they would.
We still call Pelvicochromis pulcher a crebensis.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh.
So what is a mouth brooder? That's the fun. So we talked about bettas for community tanks. We talked about bettas that you can treat like killifish. How about bettas you can treat like cichlids?
Yeah.
They're mouth brooders. And some of them, as tough as a lot of the cichlids out there, of course you're going to find a tougher cichlid, yes. But you're going to find some wimpier cichlids than some of the bettas that are out there.
Yeah.
I would never keep checkerboards with Unimaculatas, that's for sure.
They'd probably eat them.
Yeah. But I kept Unimaculatas in my community, and they were a blast. They were perfect for it.
They're my favorite attainable mouth brooder. I'm using that word very specifically because one of my all-time favorite fish is a mouth brooder, and we'll get there. But
yeah.
So what complex are we talking about?
Okay,
then?
So there's so many different complexes. We're going to breeze through complexes quickly, and we're going to delve into some of the ones we care about. But some of them, there's just fish that aren't available, and some of them, they're kind of boring brown fish. There are some of them that fall into that category, right? Like Betta acarensis complex. As I look through the list of species in that complex, I've never seen a single one of them in the hobby.
Same.
They have that mouth brooding betta shape, which is a little different. It's usually a little more elongate than splendens.
And they look grumpier.
They do look grumpier.
They've got that and flat shorter head, fins and, downturned mouth.
Yeah. But that's a soft, acidic water. They're all paternal mouth brooders. That means the male, and I believe all bettas are paternal mouth brooders. But the male is the one who incubates the eggs in his mouth. The next complex has some of my favorites in it.
Albi marginata?
Yeah.
You're going alphabetically.
That's the one that I think deserves to be far more popular because I argue that they are as beautiful, if not more so, than the macrostomas. They're smaller, and they are not as sensitive about soft water.
It's true.
As the macrostoma, so they're much more attainable.
They're incredibly hardy, I think, that we've found. We've had some that we've kept for long periods of time. And
we have a Chanoides downstairs that's been here longer than I've been working in the store.
I don't know why nobody wants him.
There's only two species in the complex. That's Alba marginata and Chanoides. They are very, very similar looking fish. Alba marginata, Albi is white, margin is margin or fin edge. So they've got a little bit more white on the edge of the fins. Otherwise, they're beautiful red little fish with black and white fins. They're just super cool.
And for people in the club, both of these species are care species. So get on it.
Yeah, they're a striking, show-stopping fish that would make a great centerpiece for a small community or is worth setting up a little breeder tank for. I think they definitely are.
Lots
of personality.
Their colors do come out a little better in soft acidic water, but that you can breed them in tap water with driftwood and peat moss and things like that.
But they don't want it like super soft acidic. Like we're talking like 6.5 max.
Yeah.
Like maybe cutting with a little RO water or something like that would be fine for them. We've had successful spawns. We have not had successful fry raised.
I think that has to do with the hardness of the water, personally.
It could just have to do with attention paid to it.
Think
we weren't really trying to spawn them at the time. They just sort of happened to.
True.
Right now, I'm running on a hypothesis that it's bacterial loads, not acidity, that's the problem, because those were tanks that definitely were not being cleaned as often as they should have been.
I predict if you would take two pairs, put one of them in half RO, half tap, dirt bottom, put some driftwood in it, put a pair in it, add some of your famous Moena cultures, and in the other one, set it up with pea gravel, still put driftwood in it. Use regular tap water. Don't do water changes on either tank. I bet we'd get babies in the first tank, not the second one.
All right, fine. If you're going to really pull our leg on it, we'll set up two tanks for Betta Alba Marginata if you're going to insist.
I insist.
I would be curious to see that result.
Yeah, that'd be a great experiment, honestly.
Yeah, let's do it. Make it a plan.
So, like, the theory would be that the eggs are calcifying, right? That would be...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a labyrinth fish. The water quality is not going to make that much difference.
Well, I think Charles's point is that there's more bacteria in higher pH water than there is in lower pH water.
Yeah. So, in their specific case, I think it's bacterial load that's the problem, that they're, like, eating away at the eggs. Because their natural habitat does swing pretty hard, but because they can get as high as like 180 parts per million in the wild. And that's like, I get that we're harder here, but that's
hard.
But that's not that much different than ours. But there is some evidence, at least in other complexes, that like in the Unimaculata and in the Picta complex, that bacterial loads are a problem with them. But in those complexes, hardness is never a problem. So we'll find out.
Yeah.
So the real experiment then would be softened acidic water with little to no water changes, or neutral regular tap water, but major water changes and major filtration.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's the experiment. Let's do it.
That would be really fun.
I like it. So the next complex only has two species in it, Anabantoides. And again, they both look very similar. Paternal mouth brooders, very uncommon in the hobby. Okay, wait. I've got Bellica in the... Oh, that's right. Never mind. Skip Bellica. Domitiata is the next complex. Mm. Two species in there, but Domitiata we definitely see.
We have it in the store right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these guys are not picky about water chemistry at all.
I would love to get my hands on Kratos sometime.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. They are a little cooler looking Domitiata. Than
Domitiata. But do they both have like a spade tail?
They both have a spade tail. These guys actually do want the water to be around 72 degrees.
Okay.
If you want to keep a betta without a heater, keep Domitiata.
Sure. Is that an altitude thing?
A lot of it has to do with streams. So,
okay.
Like... A lot of the bubble nesters like it warmer because they come from stagnant water.
Right.
A lot of the mouth brooders can't build nests because they don't come from stagnant water. They come from moving streams.
Okay.
Yeah. Betta edithae is the only species in that complex. It is a paternal mouth brooder. These guys are a little bit on the medium to bigger side. And they're on the fairly typical wild type betta look. They've got a really nice blue edge to the fin. Otherwise, it's kind of a brown fish. Soft, acidic water, definitely a blackwater fish. Kind of surprisingly boring in coloration for a blackwater fish.
Yeah, but one of the prettier if you just want one of those, like, it's so distinctly wild betta.
Yeah, absolutely. The Betta Forshei complex, on the other hand, is full of some of my favorite... Favorites are too many. I'm not going to categorize like that.
They're all
right. I love wild type betta.
No, this one's my favorite.
But Betta Forshei has Dennis Youngi in it. Forshei, Mandor, Rubra, and Strohei all in it. Now, Strohei and Mandor we don't see very often, but Rubra, Forshei, and Dennis Young.
Mandor was actually the first wild betta that I was exposed to.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm. We had them in when I started working here, and I loved them.
Okay.
We have some F1 Denny Songies downstairs right now.
There.
Yeah.
Those are
so amazing. The pattern on those is really unique.
They're very distinctive.
Yeah.
Rubra and Dennis Young were originally one species, with Dennis Younga being a subspecies.
Yeah.
But the splitters got a hold of it, and now those are two species. They are a soft, acidic water recommended, and they often are from black water. And they've got the bold colors that you would expect from black water species.
To my knowledge, though, just fun fact, the F1s we have in our basement right now were bred by a guy who did not soften the water.
No, I think that's pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah. More experimentation.
Let's try it.
The Picta complex, not picky about water chemistry. These guys, I would say, are, again, the typical wild-type betta look. In fact, sometimes they look almost like a female splendens, although they are truly a mouth brooder.
Wait, you're going to have to read out species when we go through this, because you guys have that both in your notes and I don't have it.
All right, so Betta falks, Betta picta, Betta simplex, which is probably the one we see the most often.
Yeah, although falks made the rounds around the club recently as an easy breeder, so keep an eye out for those.
Betta picta is considered the rabbits of the Betta mouth brooders. Yeah. They will not stop.
Maybe this one we should categorize as the best beginner mouth brooding wild type bettas.
Yeah,
I can agree that.
Yeah, I would say that for sure, because we had babies coming in for a while. I don't know, people maybe got bored of them. We haven't seen them in a while, but there was a while where we just kept getting them.
Yeah, and if you want to do a mouth brooding wild betta, I think Betta picta might be your best place to start because of this complex. They're the smallest species. You could easily do a pair of them in a five and not have problems.
No problem.
Yeah.
Yep, easily.
Great idea.
Very cool fish. The Pugnax complex is one of the larger complex, but not very well represented. Pugnax does show up. As I'm looking at the list in Pugnax, Enisei shows up. Ferox shows up.
Oh, I like Enisei.
Enisei is a good one. Yeah. These are, again, more of the medium-sized wild-type bettas. Not too picky about water chemistry. They do have, a lot of them have the really cool spade tail. The colors are pretty good.
Yeah, I think
some of them get some really good blue on them.
Yeah, yeah. That's Enisei, I think. The rim on that in their spade tail has that black stripe on it.
Enisei might be, this complex might be the most like messy of them because the definitions of like descriptions of species are not good enough. So like, even scientists are like, I can't tell if this is a Pugnax or something. Like, and I'm like, well, just a warning to would-be hobbyists that want to specialize in Pugnax bettas. Like, you could be cutting edge, but you also have to anticipate you're going to be slogging.
Oh, that's some nasty swamp water you're going through for those guys.
Literally.
Okay, so remember I said I wasn't going to pick favorites? That was a lie.
I already knew it was a lie.
Oh, it was, yeah. The Unimaculata complex contains one of my all-time holy grail fish. Definitely a fish in my top five, if not top three, and that's Betta macrostoma. These guys, the Unimaculata complex, are bigger fish. In fact, okay, fun little side story. About 10 or 15 years ago, importing snakeheads into the United States became illegal because of invasive species. So anything that was in the very large and very amazing group of fish called snakeheads, by the way, also labyrinth fish, became illegal. And one of the bettas in the complex Unimaculata, its common name was the snakehead betta. So they became really, really hard to get because customs said, oh, it has the word snakehead in it. You can't get it.
Looks like a snakehead.
These guys kind of look snakehead
like. I mean, macrostoma as a mini snakehead, like, it's kind of what it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And fun fact, the same thing happened with a Betta chanoides because chana, it looks like a snakehead.
Right.
So for a long time, the common name for that was also the little snakehead Betta. And now you'll notice on all the lists, it's now called a strawberry Betta.
Yes. Actually, that was a worthy change. Chana happens to be the genus for many of the snakeheads.
Yeah, and if you're like me and those smaller snakeheads are so cool and I wish I could get my hands on it. And they have no reason to be illegal around here because they are tropical fish that cannot survive our waters. Anyway, soapbox, I'm going to stop. But
bettas.
Bettas.
Yes.
These are the replacement.
the ones that we see in the hobby, I don't see Kumpukta. Gladiator shows up. IDI I've never seen. Macrostoma. My all-time favorite. We're working with them. Ocelota shows up. Palafina, never seen. Pototai, never seen. And Unimaculata, we have in stock right now.
Yeah. Honestly, Macrostoma, Ocelota, and Unimaculata are plenty. They're both of those.
Gladiators.
All of those are amazing
Don't
fish.
Downplay the gladiators.
No,
They're
I just
amazing.
Haven't seen them personally. Yeah.
I would love to get my hands on, it's an undescribed Unimaculata complex. It's Betta species Antuta. And they basically, like, they have the thick scales that Unimaculata males got on their cheeks. It's their entire head.
So Betta Ocelota was my first exposure to wild-type bettas in general, but then also to this complex. And when I kept them, I had these five big, huge adult males. They were like 5 or 6 inches long. I mean, these guys were just monsters. I have to admit something. The only place I had to put them was a 5.5 gallon tank. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to put them in here for a little while I get this 30 gallon cleaned out, because they're much better than 30 gallon. And they were in there for maybe 3 weeks in this 5.5 gallon tank. Big water changes. Don't worry. I kept good care of them. Baby showed up in a 5.5 gallon tank with five amazing adult betta ocelotas. This group of fish went through the aquarium club, ravaging the club, because they were rabbits. They produced so many fry that people couldn't keep up. They were going for a buck a bag.
God, I wish I was around then.
Oh. I wish that strain was still around.
Honestly, you got to keep on those trends, because it's like a flash in the pan, and now you can't get them.
Right.
Like, I haven't seen that fish.
No.
That's so the Unimaculata pair downstairs, those are my babies. That's why they're kind of where they're at right now, because I'm like, I don't want to lose that.
No, they're fantastic fish that we don't see that often, and those have a collection location.
And they're very spunky.
I love them.
They do recognize people, and they do, well, like the male was trying to fight Robbie through the glass when he was downstairs earlier.
Yeah, my betta Unimaculatas recognized me just so that they knew that they were about to bite me when I started putting my hands in the tank.
They are the ones that you market those to cichlid keepers. Like, yeah. I want badass fish because I keep cichlids.
Yeah.
Betta Unimaculata, buddy.
Yeah. Fantastic mouth brooders, beautiful fish, not shy in the least.
5.5 gallons is too small for these fish. I'm not endorsing that. It was not a good idea.
But it worked.
The other amazing thing that happened with these fish is there was this teeny little, maybe a half inch hole, like to put your finger in to get the lid off of the tank.
Oh, God.
Right. And in my fish room at the time, they were in a corner tank. And I came downstairs one time and there was one betta ocelotus in the tank. Oh, crap. What did I do? And I could see that finger hole, you could just see that something had happened there. Somehow the other four had wiggled their way out. Mm. And there was one in the tank below it. There was one in the tank to the left of it. And there was one in a 5 gallon bucket, two in a 5 gallon bucket on the floor in front of it.
Yeah.
All of them were fine. But there was some distance jumping for those guys.
Yeah. That's happened with my Unimaculatas as well.
Wild type bettas jump. The reason Betta splendens is not considered a jumping fish is because those big, huge, long fins weigh them down. Wild-type bettas jump.
Yeah, so do Plackett domestics.
They are good at it.
Oh, yeah.
Have I ever told you the time my male Unimaculata jumped out?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, God, he's... I had the lid off, and I was, because I was there cleaning the tank, and he jumps, and I'm being 100% serious. It's going to sound cartoonish. This is what happened. He jumped, he landed on my windowsill, and he flipped into the frame of the window, and he used the frame to start wiggling away from me. Like, he was literally snaking along it, and I had to like flick him out into my hand to get him back in the tank.
They could easily make their way into nearby water sources.
Yeah.
If they need to.
I thought that I had closed up every gap, and I had a 40 gallon tank, so it's not like they only jump if you jam them in a 5.5. That's just what they do. And once one of them found a hole and I thought I had covered up all of them, it was just I had taped it up and they found a way out. I found my Betta Unimaculata 20 feet across the room.
Oh, geez.
Like, I don't know what she had done to get there. She did not make it, but she was that far across the room just by crawling. And like, where are you going? I don't know. I don't keep them in that tank anymore because I realized I could not close it up well enough. So that's definitely something to keep in mind. Wow. Amazing jumpers.
Amazing jumpers. Amazing fish. That complex. I can't. We could go on. We could do a whole podcast about how
I could talk about betta macrostoma for the whole podcast.
That is something that I feel a privilege for having.
Yeah.
That I've seen 4-5 live macrostoma in my life. Two males ever that I've seen in my entire life. And one of those males was ours.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel the need to say that I think that jumping quality in bettas is kind of a plus for them, because their ability to do that stems from the fact that they are very athletic fish.
Yeah.
And that's part of their appeal to me, because they are capable of doing they are way stronger than they look like they're capable of being.
Yeah, they're like pure, if they're not obese, they're pure muscle.
Yeah. So the trick to avoid that is, and this is what I do in my fish room and here in the store, is bettas get fed 6 days of the week. On the seventh day, they don't get anything because that allows them to clear out their system and not be like build up anything. Mm-hmm. And that seems to work for a lot of other people in the area too.
Yeah, the bloating is what, like, it just keeps compacting.
Even
so
with
gotta,
the wild types.
Yeah, you got to flush out.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've seen some fat pug necks and I'm just like, oh my God, what did you do to it?
So betta macrostoma, the reason it's such a holy grail fish is because of its price. When you break down where they come from, you kind of get a sense of why they're so expensive. So betta macrostoma is endemic to the island of Borneo, and they live only in a few small streams up in the mountains on the island of Borneo. It is something like a two-day hike to get back to those streams. And the, I believe it's king of Borneo, has said, you cannot take betta macrostoma out of my country anymore.
Yeah.
Some have made it out, sometimes under questionable circumstances, sometimes under exceptions of the king, but it has happened. So you think, right? So just for a little side note, in 1988, I believe it was, the first four Libetochroma ceruleus, which would be the yellow lab, were exported from Lake Malawi. It was 20 years before another group of Libetochroma ceruleus were exported out of Lake Malawi. But between 1988 and the next 20 years, there were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Libetochroma ceruleus yellow labs available to hobbyists for $4.99.
Where are my thousands of betta macrostomas? Right. Thank you very much.
Betta macrostoma, they produce two or three batches a year and about 10 fry if you're lucky. Libetochroma ceruleus, every 2 weeks, they're producing 30. Even if you don't care that much. So we have a very, what we call a low yield producing fish that's very hard to get your hands on.
It's the same reason, partially the same reason that the zebra pleco is so expensive. Exactly. It's a similar story. Difficult or impossible to access in their native habitat, small batches in captivity.
And not easy to breed.
And one thing also keep in mind on top of that, the Betta unimaculata complex is one of the least picky when it comes to water quality. That does not hold true for macrostoma. They appear to be a true softwater betta if you want to breed them. Whereas the unimaculata, they have never given me trouble on Michigan tap water.
Ocelotus was the same way. They didn't care about water quality at all.
I saw a video someone sent me of their ocelotus spawning in a tank that had... It was basically the substrate you would use in an African cichlid tank. And they were like, so he was like, that it was probably like 8.1. And they were like, this is fine.
That's good. Only one complex left, the Betta wasseri complex. It's another one that just, it doesn't show up. Betta pie I've seen, I think, yeah, that's the only one in that complex that I've seen. They're another one, they want soft acidic water, and they're kind of boring brown little fish. Paternal mouth brooder. Got to mention them because they're still one of the complexes, but...
Yeah, and when we say boring brown fish, we mean of the super cool genus of betta. They are slightly less cool.
All right, I can go with that. I can go with that.
Because if we saw one of those on our lists, yeah, we're getting it in.
We would try it.
Absolutely.
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 Yeah. They still have all of the cool characteristics of mouth-breeding bettas.
And I have no reason to suspect they wouldn't be as personable as every other wild betta I've ever worked with.
True.
Yeah, they're such a blast. They have no fear. Like, macrostoma is the perfect example of it because you can see videos of them in their native habitat, like, and somebody submerges a camera and, like, 20 macrostomas come over like, hey, what's that? Like, they're just in-your-face personality.
Pretty Some much look all like, bettas. Hey, what's that? Can I fight it?
Yeah. Can I eat it? Can I fight it? No? Well, it's still probably pretty interesting.
Yeah, let's check it out.
It's amazing. We gotta love bettas.
Well, if you haven't noticed, we have talked about one of our favorite group of fish here at the Water College Aquarium Gallery. All of us have found a certain special place in our hearts for all kinds of members of the genus betta, whether it be some of the wild types, some of the fancy types that we've gotten in, some really carefully selected bred, beautifully unique ones, and some, okay, this is just this really cool, normal blue Betta Splendens that...
That I taught to do a obstacle course, you know?
Yeah. It's a genus that's like inspiring at every level of the hobby, at the super captive bred level, at the rare wild level. Like, everyone can find something to love here. Community bettas. I mean, there's just something perfect for everyone.
You can be a person that's okay with hybrids. You can be a snooty anti-hybrid person, and you're still at place in this genus.
You can be the snob that needs an exact collection location before you consider the fish to be valid. And
or you could want a pretty fish that's going to sit in your desk at work.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
It's perfect. It covers everybody. There's a betta for everyone.
Is there another group of fish that diverse?
Carassins? I don't know.
If you want a
a genus.
2.5 not gallon, a genus. There's not a carassin I put in a 2.5 gallon tank.
Yeah.
Long term.
Yeah.
Killies.
Yeah.
But there's not a killifish that I'd put up against a lot of cichlids. No, that's not true. There are a couple.
I'm just sorry.
Live bearers. There are some Psylliids.
But the thing that we need to remember, because we're not even talking about anabentids, we're just talking about bettas.
Just bettas.
So name me a genus that's as diverse, as applicable to everyone as bettas, and that's impossible.
I think you
got to put
it
up against families to get that sort of diversity.
You're right.
Yeah, sorry, I was trying to process that. I was like, I guess I wouldn't argue that bettas are the most popular fish because goldfish are everywhere. They're so ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But I think there's an argument to be made that they might be the most beloved fish in the world because I know a lot of people love their goldfish, but most people who keep bettas do generally fall in love with that betta fish.
True. I think it's gotten so many people into keeping fish.
There's such a better choice for a small tank than a goldfish.
Yeah, and it's probably a betta.
It's the betta option.
All right. That's probably, that means it's time to
it's
end.
It's time to wrap this up. Huh?
We're cutting you off.
So tell us about your bettas. Tell us about your favorite experience with bettas. Tell us what you think about the idea of putting a betta in, like, who's right? Is Amy right that saying you shouldn't put one in something smaller than 5 gallons? Is it okay to do them in 1 gallon bowls? I think we all agree nothing smaller than 1 gallon.
Yeah.
A well cared for 1 gallon? Sure.
Yeah. And you know, I really wouldn't even argue that. I would just say it's more work than I want to do, and it's more fun to do them in a bigger tank.
I can't argue with that either.
Let us know if there are any bettas you would like to see in the store.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and if we get interest in even some of those rare ones, we'll track them down.
We'll find them.
I'm always happy to have a reason to hunt down a rare betta.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If you want to see more information on some of these individual complexes, the International Betta Congress. Yes. International IBC. If you just do Google a betta and a scientific name, IBC is going to come up. That has been such a great reference for me for learning about some of the different species. If you want to learn more about how we keep some of these, look for some of our YouTube videos where we're going to highlight some of these species individually, maybe complexes individually.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Check us out on all of those famous social media networks like...
You can look us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Check out our YouTube channel. You can even give us some feedback. Email podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com. You can post a comment underneath this episode on our website. Just get in touch. Let us know what you're looking for and let us know how we're doing.
And don't be shy to say, hey, can you do a podcast on this group of fish? I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about that.
Yeah, even if it's Lake Malawi cichlids, if somebody asks us to do it, I'm sure we'll do it.
We'll do it.
But if someone asks us to do a pistos,
we're all over
that. Definitely going to do that.
Well, in the meantime, let's always try to keep it fun and keep those hands wet.